Hi everyone, we are back with Mental Health in Pop Culture with a podcast. My name is Anna and I'm here with Scott and Adam today. Today we will be talking about a movie from the 1999, I believe, Girl Interrupted. So, what are your guys' impressions on it before we begin?
Well, I have to say I've been looking forward to this discussion all week because I think that this film and the trivia surrounding it is really rich with things for us to talk about related to mental health issues and professional helping.
Mm-hmm. I was also very excited. I read the book years ago in high school, and I own the film. I've watched it many times. Mm-hmm. I always remember being just completely obsessed with Lisa's character, mm-hmm. and that's kind of how I came to love and still do love Angelina Jolie. And, sure. You know, she has her Oscar for this film, and I just, it first actually made me really want to be an actor, watching Angelina Jolie, and then now it kind of made me more into the mental health field rather than that, so it's kind of a full circle film for me.
What are some of the things that you noticed right away about her character that drew you in?
Well, I mean, there's so much to be said about, well, her character in the film, for sure, different than the character of the book, mm-hmm. But someone who is more of like the cluster B kind of personality disorder has a natural tendency to kind of draw people in and make you want to love them and want to be their best
that
friend.
The charisma.
Yeah, and she was perfect in it. So, mm-hmm. I mean, I remember even using her lines when we were younger, like incorporating them into our real life. Like we just, mm-hmm. there's one line, and I'm sorry, it's like crass and whatever, but my friend and I used to go back and forth and we'd be like, that's fucked up, Molly. That's fucked up, Adam. Like we just would do it back and forth, and it was so funny.
Yeah.
And it was from Lisa.
Well, and I was interested in researching for this discussion that Angelina Jolie, during the filming of Girl Interrupted, she refused to have any contact with Winona Ryder outside of the filming because she didn't want to start to like her. And she thought that would influence her ability to portray Lisa as well as she did.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting.
And I mean, the character, it was a juicy character. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of actresses who wanted that role at the time. And I don't believe Angelina, I mean, she'd had Gia before this, and she had a made-for-TV movie that I think she got a Golden Globe for. But she wasn't really, really well-known. It kind of brought her to, and now she's one of the most famous people in the world. So it's kind of interesting.
And it is interesting because the main character is not her, but she almost like takes the spotlight.
Absolutely.
And it's very much like that personality that is portrayed and how that personality impacts all of the people in the hospital.
Yeah. I think there were even rumors at the time that, I mean, her and Winona did like each other, but there was a little bit of a, not a feud, but that Winona was a little piffed that, you know, it was her comeback movie. It was her,
right.
You know, she had bought the rights to the film 7 years prior.
She was definitely emotionally invested in this film.
And then Angelina was the golden child.
And really, the character, and I know that Susanna Kaysen is a real person, but we're talking about a character in a film here. And the Susanna Kaysen character is more subdued. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if we want to go into...
Before we continue, I just wanted for people who have not had experience with this film and just a brief summary. Mm-hmm. This film takes place in the 60s, and it is a story about a girl who experiences being signed into a mental health hospital, a psychiatric hospital, and her journey about recovery and self-identity from what I saw from the film, and her interaction with the staff and the other patients in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to mention that, and it's very interesting. I found seeing how this was, 50 years ago about, and how it relates to our experiences with mental health today.
Yeah.
And it's a true story. The real Susanna Kaysen lived a version. I think her book is probably more realistic to her lived experience, but the book, or the movie, is based on the book, which is based on her true story, mm-hmm. living there. I think I read at one point in the book that she was supposed to go in for like 2 weeks and ended up staying for a year and a half.
Wow.
Which is incredible.
And I haven't read the book, so I'm going secondhand, but what I read about reading the book is that, a meta reading, if you will, that Susanna Kaysen, the author, makes frequent reference to her 2-year stay in the hospital was based on a 20-minute psychiatric interview.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, she had, she insisted for a long time that she didn't attempt suicide, but she did take a massive amount of pills. And then after that evaluation, they said, "You can go and get assessed and relaxed."
Yeah.
Come on in.
Welcome.
We
have a little table in the center now.
Yes, yes. Just so you know, we are recording.
Yep. We're being joined by Olivia.
Yes, hello. The atmosphere has changed. Environment.
But yeah, I think that's actually being played out in the film where it is shown as somewhat of a brief assessment and more of a one-way assessment in the film where I believe it's Melvin that is, or is it a different doctor that is interviewing her in the beginning?
It's a different doctor in the beginning, I believe a friend of the family.
Yeah.
And then Melvin is one of the primary doctors in the psychiatric facility.
Yeah, so to me, the first couple of assessments seemed very one-sided and more of like almost pushing the diagnosis on to the client as opposed to letting her speak. And although the doctor in the beginning asked her of her opinion, like, oh, so how is it for you? It didn't seem like it was a comfortable environment or a very trusting environment where I didn't feel like the client was trusted by the psychotherapist.
And then when she got to the hospital and Valerie, Whoopi Goldberg's character, who ends up, I think, being a strong ally of Susanna, but she was present there for that initial assessment at the hospital. And she was really pressured into signing onto things that she didn't agree with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually have a few quotes that I wrote down. Like when she was going through the signing process, she was like, well, no, my parents want me to be here. Maybe, like, shouldn't they sign for me? And they were like, well, you have to sign it. It's your decision. So that responsibility for signing into the hospital, even though it was not the client's decision, was put on her.
And the character was supposed to be 18 years old, fresh out of high school.
Yes.
So it was very much like, you know, your parents have made your decisions your entire life, and then suddenly you're signing yourself into a psychiatric wing of a hospital.
Yeah.
And it was huge, especially for a woman in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
I think she had no idea what she was getting herself
into. And some very strong opinions around that. Another quote that I had was that this place is perfect for people like you. And that was said by the first doctor, the friend of the family.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was watching, it had a strong reaction from me because I was like, how does he know that it's a perfect place for people, quote unquote, like her? Mm-hmm. What kind of person is she? You know, and I'm not sure that, you know, whether or not he really had an idea.
Well, I'm not sure if you already mentioned it, but what about the reaction of saying, when he said, we'll call a cab, and she said, well, my mom's here, and he just said, we already discussed it. Like, you know, when we talk about confidentiality, things being broken, and discussions, it's always, you know, would you like us to call your parent together?
Sure.
It's just all these decisions outside of the conversation with
them.
Her. Yeah. So I was just like, if I walk in a room, my parents, they talk to this guy, and then he's like, oh, well, your fingers, you said you didn't have bones. And then he just abruptly asks her, are you stoned right now? Just everything was just seemed like almost, I want to say it was jagged, where it just didn't make sense, just chopped. But it also shows how everything was kind of put on her in a sense that it was, you're going to go to this hospital. This is the facility for you. And then the interaction between her and the cab driver was interesting too, there and back. But I don't know. Just a lot of thoughts, but mm-hmm. I think that line really made it stick out to me that a lot of decisions kind of happen outside of her being in the midst.
Mm-hmm. And then when she gets there, she's forced to make this decision on herself, yeah. where all the previous ones were made for her as if she were still a mm-hmm. child.
Yeah. So. I think like it really speaks to the volumes of not only mental health in the 60s, but mental health of women, young women
yes.
in the 60s. Mm-hmm. I don't even, I wasn't around then, I don't know what it was like, but I really have a feeling that this is a pretty accurate portrayal of what would be told to someone in that time. You're sexually promiscuous, and I'm using air quotes, I know you can't see that, for a woman in the 60s, you have thoughts outside of what you're supposed to do,
yeah.
So you must be crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Definitely a lot of gender norms and social standards that I've noticed in this film. Like when the nurse or one of the attending staff was like, well, what do you plan to do? I plan to write. But yes, okay, but what do you plan to actually do?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
you're asking this of an 18-year-old who just finished high school. And, you know, it's like you've already have to have your life all planned out and know exactly what you're going to do. And if you're not going to college, well...
Sadly, I think we still do that.
Yeah.
I think that was actually a flashback to her, what at the time would have been called a guidance counselor.
Oh, mm-hmm.
And just really showing, and it's sort of that the first arc of the film really is sort of ineffective or questionable practices by the mental health professionals.
Mm-hmm. Also, the flashback she had in the introduction, they're talking about the daughter of one of the parents' friends, and she's, oh, how is she? What's going on? It's already mapped out. Everyone's extremely excited. That enthusiasm is not shared for her.
Right.
And it's definitely not something where she feels supported in her own decisions because they are being made for her. And I think that continues throughout the film, whether it's parents, the staff.
The parents and the friends of her parents reminded me a lot of the Beth character from Ordinary People.
Mm-hmm.
Really concerned about image
mm-hmm.
and less concerned about their child.
Mm-hmm.
Which played out in when the parents and Susanna were in the room with Dr. Melvin.
Mm-hmm.
And then the parents bring up the borderline personality disorder diagnosis, and Susanna says, what is that? And they explain it. And I thought there was an interesting part where Susanna said, well, is it genetic? And Dr. Melvin says, well, there's 5 times increase if one of your parents has it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the mom reacts in what I would describe as a borderline way.
Yes, works out.
Yeah.
She is a little verklempt and, oh my.
Yeah, it was all about her.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It was, oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say within that same scene, when they bring up borderline, she also recalls something that happens when she was a child. And he's like, we're not there yet. But yet you brought up a diagnosis that you haven't even discussed with the client. And you're talking about all these other things. And it doesn't seem like any norms, ground rules, nothing has been set. So it's kind of difficult to bring in Susanna and say, okay, we're going to talk about all these different things, but then we're going to pause your parents at certain parts and then not even explain to you fully what we've written or what we've been thinking.
Right.
Not very much transparency. I would
assume that's a very, like, 60s Freudian kind of way of looking at things, where the therapist is the expert and you are to follow what they say and do what they do.
Yeah, we're not even in the, you know, fifth wave.
No, we're in postmodern. Yeah.
Oh, no.
It's a little harder to look from that lens.
I mean, this is real medical model.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember, like, watching this originally, too, back in high school and thinking, like, she's not crazy. Like, she's not. And, like, you know, I think that we are a little more... the more I do research and I continue to work in the field, I'm realizing what borderline looks like or sounds like or reads like. And to think that someone maybe was diagnosed with that and hospitalized for a year and a half to 2 years, it's a really long stay for someone who may or may not have borderline. But I remember watching it this time around and thinking more from a clinician standpoint than I did before, or a counselor standpoint. Like, the facts remain that this individual did think that they had no bones in their hand
right.
at some point
mm-hmm.
and had a pretty serious suicide attempt. And it was just something that was so different this time watching it after years of not seeing it and having my training.
Yeah, and in addition to the suicide, so I went through a similar experience re-watching it within the past week. And she, so, because in the internet discussions that I looked at, there's real questioning of did she have a mental illness or not? But I end up kind of going with what Adam said, that she didn't think she had bones in her hand. She was having some sort of psychotic episodes. And also she was doing self-harm in that she would bang her
yeah.
wrist to hurt herself.
Mm-hmm.
To make sure that she had
yeah.
bones.
Yeah, yeah. And overall, I really like how you phrased it at the beginning, Anna, that this movie was kind of about her journey to recovery.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also, I felt like, her journey to understand what is reality.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that starts out with the beginning of the film, where she would almost seamlessly go into past recollections. And
mm-hmm.
as she said before, you know, the time, it's not constant. It's not something that can be controlled. It goes backwards, it goes forwards, it goes up and down. And, you know, for her, it was difficult. And that reminds me of some, you know, psychotic symptoms that may have been, but throughout the film, those stopped pretty quickly after her first initial, you know, weeks or maybe a month or so
mm-hmm.
of her being in the hospital. So I'm very glad to see that they weren't as troubling for her, and she transitioned less about struggling with reality as opposed to struggling with her inner self and her identity and connection with the world. And, like, her place in it and her place within the hospital.
I think that, yeah, because, like, some of her symptoms and whatnot didn't really show up as much after the first few months, you said, like, of treatment. But one of the things that kind of, like, stood out to me, and I don't want to, like, get to the end scene this early or anything, but when she did have an injury to her hand toward the end of the film, she was shocked that there were bones in the hand at that point. So it was almost as if she almost put on a front. Like, this is what I'm supposed to act like, which is actually, I looked up some of the stuff about the book to remind myself of, like, what the book was, because I did read it over a decade ago. And one of the things that Susanna Kaysen had said in the book is some people fall into insanity gradually while others just snap, which I thought was a really great description of what was happening to her. Like, she wasn't completely unhelpable, or not that I think anyone's unhelpable. But it wasn't like you meet this person and think, oh my gosh, like the Lisa character.
Right.
But there was something wrong, and she was kind of falling into it. And I'm trying to remember, there was something else. I don't know whether it was in the book or in like a review I read years ago, but it said it's hard to watch this film and not wonder yourself, am I crazy?
Yeah, and she said, she talks about this a little bit in the end of the film, where
mm-hmm.
she has a lot of thoughts about these things, and one of the, you know, ways that she really helps herself is by writing all of these thoughts down. But as she speaks in the end of the film, like, how do we know? Like, am I crazy or am I normal? What is normal? And there's a lot of these deep questions that are explored in the film. But to me, it's mental illness, mental health is on a continuum.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that somebody can be labeled as quote-unquote crazy or insane. And mostly, can they be happy and be, you know, function in society to such a way that they can meet
yeah.
their needs? And society deemed that at the beginning of the film she could not do that, and that she should be put into a place where those needs can be met, or those needs could be met for her. And throughout that, you know, that experience, that stay, it's really about where am I and can I interact with the world?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just kind of found as I was looking through the, I don't know if it's an exact quote or something that was written about Susanna afterward, but she had suggested in the book that sanity is a falsehood constructed to help the healthy feel normal in comparison, which I thought was just such an interesting thing.
I love
thing.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's so much we can get into with this.
And it's a great comparison to the social norms that are presented in the film.
Yeah.
That the contrast between the gender stereotypes, the social norms that
mm-hmm.
she's supposedly expected to fit into, the what are you planning to do with your life kind of thing, and
mm-hmm.
the how do I experience life? Like, is this really... are these... do I fall into these gender norms? Do I not? Like, where do I fall in? And I think it's actually very relevant to a lot of, you know, young adult and adolescent questions about life,
mm-hmm.
except it's a very concentrated, you know, like, confined setting in mental hospital. But I think many, you know, adolescents, young adults, adults question these things, like, where do I fall in
Absolutely.
To life?
I mean, look at human development theory and whatnot. There's a reason that a lot of these mental health issues start to arise around that 20 years old, 22, 18, you know, around that age. It's a lot when you're that age being told, okay, now figure out what you're going to do with the rest of your life and don't make a mistake and now you're an adult and good luck. And like,
yeah, I think that there's something to be said about expectations. So even as an adolescent, there are certain expectations, whether it's developmental or just respecting parents. And then once you get to a young adult, there are still expectations. But not only that, you now have to function in a society that has their own expectations and judges you differently based off how you operate within or outside of those.
That's a great point, actually, and I'm going to link that to her stay in the hospital, because there are certain expectations about how the patients should
mm-hmm.
act
yes.
by the staff and
mm-hmm.
also by the other patients in the hospital,
mm-hmm.
especially, for instance, Lisa.
mm-hmm.
Who is cool to Lisa and who, you know, how they should act, like... in the introduction of Lisa, when she was first returned back to the hospital, we were shown how the different people in the hospital responded to her and how that environment changed based on her, you know, opinion or what she thought was correct or her, I don't know how to say it, but... Her Majesty.
She ran it.
Yeah.
She did. And even there's a character that we never see in the film, Jamie, who apparently she and Lisa had been best friends, and Lisa ran away for a week. So Jamie hung herself with a volleyball mat.
Mm-hmm.
That's the impact of
Lisa.
Yeah.
It's kind of amazing to see, just like you said, the reaction, the change in the whole environment, both times when she's brought back after Winona Ryder, Susanna Kaysen's character. Kind of becomes more equipped with the hospital. She's understanding things. She's working with them. And suddenly Lisa returns. And there's a whole change in just the way that they're even, like, filming the scenes at this point. It's amazing how much you hate this person that you love.
Yeah.
And I think all the characters love and hate her and are terrified of her and don't want her to go but want her to get the hell away as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's just...
I think it's one of those things where I don't want to be on her bad side. And you see that portrayal, but...
when she loves you.
Yeah.
She loves you.
And I think also that, even though it's towards the end, well, it is the end, her stealing her book and Susanna being able to express herself and say, these are thoughts, and this is how I feel, I think that's... kind of like finding her voice.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
because she was speaking and saying, you know, I wish I could have said this to help Daisy out.
Yeah.
And it was a lot of guilt and a lot of shame. And then finally, it's like I'm standing up to the bully.
Yeah.
And I don't care what's going to happen, mm-hmm. even if you all choose to stay on her side. You know, I have to let this out. And
yeah,
some freedom and freeingness in that.
Well, and that was beneficial for Lisa as well. Mm-hmm. That resulted in Lisa's own breakthrough.
Yeah.
And and Susanna said something to the effect of, you are already dead.
Yeah.
And suddenly this hardened character just really breaks down and we see the soft side, which had been foreshadowed. Okay, I watched it twice. And at the very beginning, we see this scene of Lisa had already broken down, and I think that Susanna was kind of cradling her and comforting her.
Mm.
And that was like opening scene almost, and then it's foreshadowing, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the dynamics there was that Lisa always had control in that environment, and somebody challenging that control, somebody saying, well, no, I'm not going to be part of the system that you've created, might have really been like a, you know, like you said, a breakthrough moment, because nobody has challenged her before.
Mm-hmm.
And even when they did, even when, you know, she got in trouble, she went to electrotherapy or something like that, she still felt that sense of like, well, excuse my language, fuck you all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm still in control because I have that resistance.
Yeah.
So, but being faced with that by somebody, I think that she respected.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the way Susanna did it was to say, I'm going to challenge you, but I still care about you.
Yes.
Yeah. And she really showed that at the end by still like visiting her and painting her nails.
Mm-hmm.
And...
Yeah. Yeah, that painting the nails, I thought that was really symbolic of the
because she painted
tenderness.
Susanna's two
mm-hmm.
yeah. toenails when she was just laying there.
Yeah.
So.
And I think it's such a powerful scene and a great part of the film that really kind of breaks that character of Lisa down a little. But it was very disappointing that it's not a part of the book and it actually like never happened.
Right.
It was a royalty that was made by the director or the writer.
Well, I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
I've thought about this issue a lot, so I'm just going to put it up front.
Mm-hmm.
The real-life author, Susanna Kaysen, has called the movie melodramatic drivel.
Yeah.
And that's there's, I think, three key scenes that were added. One was the scene at Daisy's apartment and the scene at the ice cream shop, and I forget the other one, that were entirely fictional.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to say I'm okay with that.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's, although it didn't actually happen, it is representative, though, of what took place in the book.
Yeah. It still stayed pretty true to the overall story.
It stayed true to the spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And it added to the film.
Yeah. And I mean, there was just, I was trying to even remember, and I was looking for the book last night, but if I remember correctly, like, Lisa also was not a very large part of the book.
No, she's a minor character, and she only appeared in, like, two chapters.
Yeah, and she wasn't made out to be the character that she is here. As a matter of fact, she was one of the people that Susanna ran into after being released from the hospital years later, who actually, Lisa had, like, a child and had run into her somewhere. I don't know if it was, like, a supermarket or something. But, like, one of the things she did was she, like, lifted up her shirt and pulled out all this extra skin to show Susanna, like, look at what your body does when you have a kid. Like, she's still, like, quirky and strange and didn't follow rules. But, like, Susanna had said she seemed, like, sane or normal. Like, she didn't seem crazy anymore.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk about Lisa's relationship with Daisy.
Mm-hmm.
So, I do think, you know, it's funny that I want to be sensitive to people who are diagnosed with anything, and particularly borderline personality disorder, which both Lisa and Susanna had been diagnosed with in the film. And And I think that it took on different forms. I think with Susanna, it was more inwardly directed, and with Lisa, it was more externally directed. But the scene in Daisy's apartment, to me, that is somewhat indicative of how borderline personality disorder can manifest itself. And so, I don't know if we need to backtrack and start talking about Daisy first.
Maybe a little. Because I think at one point you said Lisa had been diagnosed as borderline.
Yes.
Okay. That also confused me, because...
Let me say, I am a genius. And while I was watching, I paused when they were in the scene in Dr. Wick's office, and they were looking at their own charts, and Dr. Melvin, that's what he diagnosed her with.
I thought that was Susanna's file, though.
No,
the massive depressive,
well.
The like response bad to treatment or whatever, and then
maybe I'm not a genius.
So I think she was
because I'm pretty sure she
was
diagnosed as the antisocial personality,
okay,
which is a sociopath, and I think they would have used that term back then rather than
right. Okay, well, I'm going to have to go back and recheck that.
I'm not sure. I think I read about antisocial personality for her, but then. I think I kind of was just listening to everyone read bits and pieces of their own file.
Right,
so
but then
they
exchanged,
yeah.
And like Janet, the character of Janet was reading Lisa's. So we'll need to go back on that.
But it does make sense for me that Lisa was more antisocial because of that numbing of feelings towards everyone around her and being able to manipulate to the point where, you know, I don't want to use the word normal. A normal person would have an empathetic reaction that would prevent them to, you know, for instance,
absolutely.
Driving Daisy to a point of committing suicide or doing something
her
drastic.
Reaction when she
but
saw
not
her.
To the point of like not for the purpose of here I'm going to tell you the truth. The purpose really was to take her money, basically. Or at least that's what I got from
She's
it.
A toy.
Yeah, or that and that control aspect where it's like, oh, you think that you're out, you think you're fine, you think
that
you have
fine.
Your own apartment and you can live up by yourself, and I can't. Well, let me show you how crazy you are. And you know,
one of those you think you're better than me.
Yeah, that threat to the control.
Yeah,
but then I think part of the reason why I kind of question that antisocial diagnosis is the ending. Of when Lisa has this breakdown, and it almost seems that empathy. I think of back in undergrad, I had watched the Iceman Pig documentary. He had antisocial personality disorder, and to hear him talk about the murders he committed and nothing, whether it was women, a love interest. Whatever, he had no remorse, but it just seems like I felt like Lisa fluctuated a bit more, and I feel like there's some consistency in the documentary I had seen that made it a little harder to see that.
See, when I thought of Lisa's like emotional breakthrough, I thought it was more selfish. I'm not dead. You see me as this dead person, and I'm not. Like, I never really saw any sort of empathy there. I saw it more as people see me this way, and I don't want them seeing me this way, and I'm better than this, and I'm not crazy. So it was more like my character is being hurt. My pride is being hurt, and that now is, like, manifesting in this physical emotional reaction.
Okay.
Because, I mean, that's just how I saw it. I'm not sure. Now I want to rewatch it.
Yeah. Because I saw it as it was changing, like, the fact that she was merely affected by it to tears. Like, most times, if someone with antisocial personality disorder, I'm not bothered, but you can be bothered by everything because there's no empathy there. And so the fact that I'm the least bit responding to an attack towards me, to have a feeling, to me, it was like... that's when I actually pictured you in my head, like, I don't know if this is too tight. I don't know if I can. I'm like, I'm just like, I don't know. about this ending?
And we have to keep in mind, it is a film written by people who probably don't have, like, as much experience with... I'm guessing they're probably not counselors or psychotherapists or whatnot.
And it was a point of resolution that is, you know, key to a production in general, I think. Like those major points. But at the same time, when I was watching it, I had mixed feelings. I did experience what you guys are talking about. But the other thing is, what I thought was she might be breaking down for the purpose of having a tantrum. Where it's like, yes, it hit her, but her real emotions or her real, you know, inner experience may be covered by this tantrum of like, I am not in control. Oh my God, what is happening? I'm going to resume control by having this tantrum and by breaking down.
Mm-hmm. I can see that. Mm-hmm. So. I definitely want to give to Polly at some point, though.
Oh, yeah. So let's a little more about Daisy. Who was an interesting character played by Brittany Murphy. Mm-hmm. And so she only eats chickens
from her dad
in her room. It's suggested throughout that her father is having an incestuous sexual relationship with her. Mm-hmm. And we do see some evidence of that in a very brief scene of her father saying goodbye to her in the hospital. And they seem to be interacting in a seductive way when they do that. And so she seemed to be somewhat obsessed with the chickens, and she would only eat in her room.
In a very specific pattern, she would peel the meat from the bones and the flesh and save the carcass. It was very... OCD.
Yes, that's what I was thinking also. And her father seemed to have money. Mm-hmm. And then her release from the hospital, which Susanna really questioned that because she said doesn't seem to be better. Mm-hmm. I forget what Lisa said back on that. Oh, it had to do with secrets. That if you tell your secrets to all the doctors... in the Freudian sense, then they'll think that you're better, and then you will get out of here. And then Susanna said, what if I don't have any secrets? And Lisa said, I don't either, then you're a lifer like me. Mm-hmm. And so then we see Daisy in her apartment. She seems fragile, she's barely holding it together, and then Lisa and Susanna come in, and Lisa gets all manipulative, and she ends up hanging herself the next morning. Yeah. Which was powerful. Yes. And side note, then the tragedy of Brittany Murphy, the actress who portrays her, who herself was found dead in her bathroom.
Yeah.
And after the movie?
Quite some time. Okay.
I did see that as another turning point in the movie. The interaction of Lisa and Susanna post Daisy's death, where it was the first break between that connection, where to me it seemed that Susanna really realized, like, I am not like her. There is a side to her that I do not agree with, despite this connection that we fostered, and she starts to question Lisa's hold over her or in everybody in the hospital. But what you said earlier about the telling the therapist the secrets is very interesting, because later in the film it's kind of true, you know, but it's twisted by Lisa and her understanding, where to Lisa it's like, oh, they want all of our secrets, they want to make stuff up about us, they want us to talk about this stuff, where it's a negative thing to her. For her, but when Susanna actually begins to open up about the stuff that, you know, is troubling her, or all those thoughts in her head, it reverses to maybe, you know, the goal of counseling, the goal of therapy is actually recovery. Whereas Lisa sees it as, no, they have it out against us, but, you know.
Well, just imagine even having those two different diagnoses, though, if they're true diagnoses, like... a borderline person, a person with borderline, might say, you know, oh, I pushed to have them love me and then I pushed them away, where a person who has antisocial would say, like, yeah, I pushed until they killed themselves when it comes to this, like, instance. So maybe those secrets are a little bit more damning for Lisa. Why would she want to tell people those internal feelings if she really is this? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a pretty evil thing. Just, I remember loving Lisa for some reason, just her sporadic behavior and whatnot, trying, almost wanting to emulate it, until she comes upstairs and she's like, we need an ambulance, and she's like, make it a hearse. And it's almost just like this, like, what?
She goes, seeing Daisy hanging there, she goes, what an idiot.
Yeah. And I remember this huge, I had a disconnect with her after that. Like, I don't want to be that person. So I think about that, like, if that's how someone truly feels, sitting down and sharing those interpersonal feelings would seem very harsh as compared to maybe something that isn't so not normative with societal views.
But the other thing is, if you don't share empathy with other people, it may be difficult to develop trust for other people. How do you know that they're not out to get you?
Yeah.
How do you develop that trust? And, you know, I think it's actually very helpful for us as clinicians to, you know, think of it from that perspective, because we may be working with people who may not be able to trust us, may not be able to trust other people. So how do we build that relationship? How do we engage?
I don't know about you guys. I've worked with, it was more of a personal relationship, but someone who was more of a cluster B personality disorder, and it was rough.
Can you tell us what cluster B is?
Cluster B, I think, is the, I actually just went through the DSM last night to make sure they still use it, because people keep telling me DSM-5 doesn't use it, but then it's labeled as cluster B in the DSM-5. But it's the antisocial, I'm trying to remember all of them. What is it? Antisocial, there's three.
Let me look it up.
Is it schizophrenic?
Let's see.
And narcissistic?
Antisocial, histrionic, narcissistic, and borderline.
Okay.
And these are all personality disorders.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so the antisocial part of, like, working, or at least having, like, a relationship with someone like that is very, very hard. And actually ended with a restraining order that I had to take out on this person. There really is very little empathy, and they're just never wrong, ever, ever. And I see a lot of that with Lisa.
Well, let's talk about Polly.
Yes.
Torch.
Yes. I had such empathy and sympathy, really sympathy, for this character. And I'm trying to remember who all was in the book and who wasn't. I believe Polly was in the book. Daisy, who hanged herself, was in the book. And actually, she did die in real life. They got the news back at the hospital that she had hanged herself on her birthday.
Can you remind us a little bit about Polly's character?
Polly was, it's described in the film that she, at the age of 10, had a puppy or a dog, and she was allergic to the dog, so everywhere she had the allergic reaction, the rash, she poured gasoline on herself and lit herself on fire. Yeah. So she was covered in pretty severe scars.
Mm-hmm. And Polly gets the cat at the end, right?
I think so.
Okay.
Susanna,
I didn't make that connection.
Well, I actually thought about it, like, so all this happened and then she gets the cat? But it also functioned as a different reference for me to say, because she had the doll originally. And so for the shift to go from having someone there to protect, to nurture, So the dog can't talk back. He can't kind of really interact with her. But the cat, it was a shift.
Yeah.
It was like, you know, when Susanna said, can you take care of the cat until I return? You know, I'll play come during visits when I have treatment. I saw some growth there.
Mm-hmm.
To say that her wanting someone in her life or caring for someone, it served a different thing in it. Even though I'm not really so much of saying there's always something in childhood, it made me refer back to she's wanting to be she's had this passion to be nurturing for so long. What happened?
Well, she remained basically the instincts and actions of a child throughout the whole film. She held on to that. It reminds me of someone describing it like as like the Michael Jackson complex or something, where it's like staying in
Never Never Land.
Yeah.
Where people never grow up. I also think, listening to what you're saying, Olivia, reminds me of what Anna was saying about longing for a connection within this film. And I think she did. And then there was the scene where she had a break, a psychological break, and she had to be put in a room by herself, and she was screaming, and Lisa and Susanna went and took a guitar and they played the song Downtown, which I want to talk more about later. And that seemed to be comforting and healing to her.
Yes.
And that was a scene where we saw Lisa show some compassion.
Yeah. Even though it was breaking the rules, but yeah.
And Polly had that breakdown after seeing a picture of herself as a child.
That's right, and not having the scars, and she's saying, my face.
It was almost as if she'd realized, this is permanent, this is what I'm going to look like, and she was screaming, like, my face, I'm ugly, and everything, as they were kind of trying to compose her. It was heartbreaking.
Yes, that was that. But then I think it reinforces my thoughts about wanting someone to care, like, from a young age, having this childlike mentality. If I'm a child and I feel like I was never nurtured, and all I did was ever want to, you're trying to take away something because I'm breaking out. Okay, well, I'll get rid of the rashes, and then look what it cost me. And then to see myself before all of this, it's
a transition.
Yeah.
For caring about something real and, you know, something that, you know, can respond back to you and love you for who you are.
Even Lisa has pretty great insight for some of the things that she does. But like said, Polly just wants to be loved, and no one's going to love her looking like that. And I don't believe that in any way. This is Lisa's words. Like, she even said, like, let's have her be Minnie Mouse so everyone will just love her and kiss her and hug her and not know, like, what's underneath that mask.
Mm-hmm. Did anyone have any idea about the different therapies they had in here? Like music, they had
the yoga.
Yes, like I'm like dance music they're doing. Okay. Even though like I said, the ending kind of just was like I don't know about that. For the most part, I did think that they showed a variety of different techniques that could be implemented, even if they weren't implemented the best way.
Yeah, let's talk about that because So with, I think it was the yoga with Janet, who seemed to have eating disorder, anorexia.
Yep.
And so they were telling her, be a tree, be a tree. And she got frustrated and went to the floor.
And
she goes, what kind of a tree can you be there?
On the floor.
I'm an effing shrub.
Yes!
I love the little bits of humor they can throw in with this very serious film.
But I thought Dr. Melvin overall was pretty good.
Dr. Melvin, really?
Yeah.
I didn't think he was bad, except for the few things that were so stereotypical of, like, the falling asleep while they're talking.
Oh, yeah. I mean, but not horrible as things could be. And then Dr. Wick.
Dr. Wick I liked, actually.
Yeah, seemed to have end up following the time when Susanna had that insight that she's not like Lisa after the Daisy suicide, then seemed like Dr. Wick and Susanna had a really good relationship. And I don't remember Dr. Wick's first name, but I remember Susanna referencing that she had really good experience with.
It started with an M.
Whatever her name was, and so referred to her by the first name.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure, but I did question their encounter over the word promiscuity.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But she was challenging her.
Yeah, she was challenging.
And I love how much she challenged her.
Oh, and actually that was, yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Nice look.
Yeah, you're right.
I
think she did good with the word ambivalent,
but before
that.
Yeah.
But I mean, even to do something like that with the client, to completely be like, no, you're wrong, and here's what it means, but it actually fits. Like, and she's like, well, then I didn't mean that. And she's like, no, you did. Like, to be that firm with her, that's something I struggle with. Like, I thought, I mean, maybe it's Vanessa Redgraves and she can do whatever she wants. But, I mean, let's face it, like, you know, we have these incredible women in this film who, I mean, from Whoopi Goldberg to Vanessa Redgraves to Angelina Jolie, the Oscar winners in this film are insane. But
despite being stern, she did come from a place of empathy and compassion for the client. And this was actually the first time that I saw this portrayed in the film, other than, let's see, Valerie, the nurse.
Whoopi Goldberg,
the
character.
Goldberg. So that growing relationship and that compassion, but there was a disconnect, as not only, you know, on the basis of race and ethnicity, but also profession that I would like to highlight. And there were several instances. One of the instances was in the bathtub scene where she was dunked into cold water. And we had some. And I believe that Susanna's character was coming from a, you know, screw this world. Like, I don't care. I'm going to say something hurtful to you to create a reaction, to show all of these feelings that are overwhelming.
Like she was trying to be a little Lisa.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A little
yeah.
bit. And then the other scene
she was repeating that derogatory song that I think it was Janet had sung as soon as we first saw the hospital, like, oh, pick a bale of cotton, something like that.
Yeah.
It was racially derogatory.
Kind of like testing the boundaries, and expressing those emotions. But the other scene was when she was in her room, she was crying over, I want to say, Lisa or Daisy or something like that. Susanna was crying in her bed, and Valerie came to comfort her, and she was like, well, what do you know? You're just a nurse. And then I think Valerie actually confirmed it. She was like, well, why don't you speak about this with the doctors? I am here for you, but I am not the one. And so that was very interesting for me, that separation between psychiatric nurse and the doctors, the role of the psychotherapist and the staff in the movie, and that hierarchy and that like social order that was present that goes back to those, you know, social norms, the gender roles, the racial norms. So, lots of material here.
There's so much here.
Yeah, there is. And I mean, so going back to gender norms and just talk about the powerful women in this film, I thought that was just, how do I say, it was throughout the film that was something that was always there.
And to even, I mean, I'm assuming it was probably true for Susanna to write it, but that the head of the hospital, like above even Melvin, was a female psychiatrist in the 60s, which would have meant for her age, probably went to school in like the 40s or 30s. So it was really a huge movement for women in this film.
And let's talk about portrayal of men in this film in contrast. And so Melvin, not offensive, also not the greatest.
Seemed a little doofusy.
Yeah.
A little doofusy.
Yeah.
And then what other men were present? Susanna's father was almost, was mute. Yeah. I mean, not literally, but he didn't say anything.
Against his
her
wife.
Her boyfriend,
you know,
was Tony, right?
What was that?
Her boyfriend.
Her boyfriend was Toby.
Toby.
Toby. Okay.
Right. There was the professor that she had a one-night stand and that tried to go for her again, which seemed like it may have prompted her taking the aspirin and vodka. There was John, the orderly, who was nice, and but they ended up making out. And he said, and maybe this was 60s norms, I don't know, but he said he once she's out of there, he'd like to take her out to the movies.
There's also the ice cream.
Oh, the ice cream guy that Lisa kind of messes with.
Yeah.
And there's Daisy's father.
Yeah.
And the cab driver, I guess.
And the cab driver.
Yeah. Yeah. But every single one of those roles is such a sub.
Like a secondary.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And somewhat negative.
Mm-hmm. Somewhat, but
yeah,
also somewhat in subservient.
Subservient,
role.
Yeah. In a way, this movie is a testament to the power of women.
And the complexity.
Yeah.
And, you know, just how much I think we're even still seeing today that gender plays such a role when it comes to, like, well, you should act like this. I mean, we're seeing it in our political climate, and we're seeing it in this film over and over. Winona Ryder doesn't act like what a woman should, so we're going to lock her up.
The falling asleep on her graduation, that was pretty great, though.
Oh, yeah. And that's how Toby notices
her.
Yeah,
he's like, oh, you looked really cute when you fell asleep.
Yeah.
I mean, and I'm just, like, I'm sitting here looking at the cast. Like, they even went as far as to have, like, a sub-character who is gay or lesbian, who's basically locked up because she's a lesbian.
Oh, Cynthia.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And we it's very brief, but it's when they're in Dr. Wick's office and they're talking about what each other's diagnoses are, and Lisa says, well, you're here because you're a dyke or something like that. And that...
Because she tried to share the diagnosis with Lisa, what Lisa's was. And Lisa was proud of her diagnosis.
Yeah.
It's mostly men, were very rare. Like, she took that... In the book, there's actually another character who is who's also named Lisa, who's diagnosed with the same...
That's right.
And Lisa, who Angelina Jolie's character, Lisa... hates the other Lisa because...
taking a spotlight.
She is.
Yeah. And the other mention was when one of the girls acquired the nail polish, she was like, oh, I traded it with a transvestite in the men's ward.
Yeah.
That was another powerful...
So a trans person is in the men's ward. I mean, it just shows how far we've come. I mean, it has been 50 years, which is a half of a century, but still... people were literally being locked up for sexual orientation and gender.
And that goes back to that question of what should you be locked up for and how normal is normal, how crazy is crazy enough to get locked
up.
Who
defines it?
Who defines it? How do we know when you're better, quote unquote?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and after Susanna and Lisa, when they run away and they're on the way to Daisy's apartment, they're picked up in a VW. Red VW microbus.
Mm-hmm.
Shout out to Arlo Guthrie, which I thought was a little cliche, but anyway, while they're in that van with these 60s hippies, so there's a little brief makeup between the two of them. It seems to show that they're really connected, and this is coming right before Susanna's going to break away, and after Lisa sort of controls Daisy into being suicidal.
Mm-hmm. And that concept of freedom that Lisa values so much.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she is portrayed as, you know, this ideal of freedom in this restricted hospital environment that is dictated by rules and by staff and everything like that, by, you know, those mental health norms. And she's that, you know, free bird that can do whatever she wants, but in reality, I'm not sure if that is so much true, because she is constrained by her own patterns, her own, you know, manipulative connections and everything like that. So, you know, that and that question, that's, if you are so free, if you can function so well outside, why do you keep coming back? Why are you here for 8 years? So that question...
It's almost like that the hospital was like where Lisa felt her sense of home and her mm-hmm. sense of belonging. And many of the major counseling theories have belonging as one of our central human motivations, that we all long for that.
We also saw that with Susanna as well, at one point of the film where she's like, well, I belong here. I have friends here. Mm-hmm. So I don't, but she rejected her boyfriend's,
right.
you know, mm-hmm. He was like, well, do you want to go? We're going to go flee to
You're
Canada.
You're not one of them.
You're not one of them. And she's like, well, I really am.
Yeah.
I haven't been able to make a connection in the quote unquote real world, but I have made a connection here
mm-hmm.
and I feel comfortable here.
And after he says that to her, that's when she says, well, no, I did try to kill myself. Whereas
yeah.
up until that point, she had been denying it all along.
Yeah.
You know, she was justifying reasons to get out the whole time that it never happened, and then needing to justify reasons to stay in.
Yeah.
And I also, like, I think it with Lisa, the idea of her keep having to come back over and over. You know, she leaves for a while, and I think she kind of realizes, like, her basic needs aren't being met, those Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Like, she's in the hospital where she has food and shelter and clothes and all these things that she basically needs to survive. And so when she's out in the real world, she doesn't have that. And a person who's having a pretty serious mental illness may have trouble getting those needs met as well. So, and also the manipulation is a lot harder in the real world with people who are functioning typically. So she's not being able to manipulate these people, or her needs aren't being met. But in the hospital, she gets to go back where people are maybe weaker than her or not as intelligent as her, and she can manipulate and control.
And the spotlight is on her.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I think Daisy did a nice job challenging her, saying, what's your safety net? Like, what's your plan?
Mm-hmm.
Like, do you have money? Do you have family, friends? Like,
mm-hmm.
you're going there to do...
Yeah.
Like,
what?
What's the purpose? What's the function? Do
yeah.
you have a plan? Is there a mission?
And think about that. Like, a person like Lisa leaving a place after that for, like, 8 years, she clearly... I mean, in the book, it talks a little bit about her having a brother and, I think, a lawyer or something. But imagine a person leaving a hospital after 8 years. Like, where do you go? What do you do?
Yeah, and I don't know if any of you have ever been in a hospital. When I was a kid, I was in the hospital once for like 3 days, and then when I was in high school, I was in the hospital for 10 days. And just that in and of itself can make you feel like you have a mental illness.
Mm.
Being confined and told what to do, and people coming in the middle of the night and flicking the light on to do all of that.
It's a completely different culture.
Yeah.
And it makes you question your identity.
Absolutely.
Because it's so different from
mm-hmm.
your,
you know, it's like there's
experience.
A loss of autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Almost like incarceration.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That question,
like, am I in
really?
Trouble? Why am I in trouble?
Yeah.
Why am I locked up? Is there something wrong with me?
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of see that in Susanna's character, where she's like, is there something wrong with me? And that idea of, like, I'm here, there must be a reason why I'm here. Is it true?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of thing. And that struggle is, like, amazing for me.
Absolutely. I love this one. This is such a great one, especially because there are so many different characters and diagnoses and whatnot in this
mm-hmm.
film.
Mm-hmm.
This is our first one where it wasn't just focused on, like, one person. Or, like, one even therapist. Like, we have multiple different roles in this one.
And actually, therapy wasn't that big part of the movie.
It wasn't.
One of the biggest parts of the movie was the interaction between the patients and
yeah.
Between the staff and stuff. It's that culture, that environment, and, you know, not necessarily like a set, you know, hero that brings you back to
mm-hmm.
wellness, quote unquote. It was that experience, and I think that's very indicative of, is that the right word, of the journey of psychotherapy, of counseling.
Absolutely.
Of discovering yourself, because the recovery is not just about going to session once a week or a couple of times a week. It's about everything that happens between sessions, in sessions, those realizations. And sometimes in movies like Good Will Hunting, it may be easy to miss that, where it's like, oh, this is what they covered in the session, and that impacted person's life, kind of like that. But it's that entire journey, it's that entire environment, it's the entirety of the environmental factors that affect a person's health in general,
mm-hmm.
and the supports that contribute to
absolutely
recovery and wellness.
A typical person has 1, maybe 2 hours a week of actual therapy, and everything else is done outside that office. So I love that this film did that and really showed life and how that impacts recovery and treatment.
And the importance of a network of support, because
absolutely.
That's what the other girls and some of the staff were for Susanna.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think group counseling, like, even though there wasn't one specific facilitator, there were still different people, staff, attendings, that functioned in their role. They spoke with all of the women there.
Mm-hmm.
However, outside of that, the group had to function on their own. And that's where they did the most learning and growing.
Yeah, now we talked about the sort of a variety of mental health professionals and diagnoses. I was troubled by some of the paraprofessionals. So we've already mentioned John the orderly,
mm-hmm.
so we've covered that. But there was also another nurse's aide or assistant, and I don't recall her being addressed by name. But there was a time that Lisa was talking to her about her upcoming wedding, and then this
mm-hmm.
nurse's aide said, well, yeah, my fiancé wants me to, you know, with him. And you know, and Lisa says, well, go ahead and have sex, but use a rubber. And I thought that was inappropriate.
Yeah. I mean, I think I guess there were some more that were a little bit more professional, because you did see, like, the person who went around and doing the checks and stuff, and it never really showed too much of a personal relationship
yeah,
there.
Mm-hmm.
There was that nurse or nurse's aide who went to the ice cream parlor with them,
mm-hmm.
and we didn't see her doing anything inappropriate.
But a number, I guess, of the young ones were portrayed as probably getting too close and sharing way
yeah.
too much personal
yeah.
information.
But here's the other thing that I was wondering, and I've never experienced working or being in an inpatient setting, but the people who work there are there all the time, and so are the patients. It's
mm-hmm.
not a once a week, couple of times a week meeting. And creating that relationship may be different than, you know, mental health workers that only briefly see a client, because it may be much easier to maintain boundaries when you have a limited time, as opposed to you see these patients every day, you're there every day, you're dealing with conflicts and issues every day. So, and during the 60s, I'm not sure, you know, if it was different or not, but I can see some of, like, different personality people would be more open about themselves simply because they're such a big part of their life,
mm-hmm.
part of their environment and culture is the hospital and these
yeah.
patients.
And I think it probably still happens a lot today. I remember my master's program not far from the university was an inpatient hospital for mental health issues, and some of the people who were getting their master's degrees worked there more as kind of orderlies or
right.
whatnot. And when we go over ethics and stuff, they'd say things like, well, you know, it's different with inpatient.
Mm-hmm.
And they did say those things frequently, and I also remember professors being like, but it's not different with inpatient, like, you can't do this. But they weren't really mental health professionals either. I don't know. It's such
right.
a strange
yeah.
dynamic. I mean, at least it wasn't like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest kind of nurse,
yeah.
where she was just
yeah.
awful.
Nurse Ratchet.
Yes. But I mean, you're right. It was really inappropriate.
Well,
times.
In my professional experience in mental health, we had lots of bachelor's level caseworkers, and they didn't have the ethics training that we had. And even fairly recently, someone close to me was hospitalized, as you're aware. And we had orderlies and nurses' aides making observations and taking notes that were then shared with the professionals, and they were very off base in what the in how they were interpreting what they thought they were seeing.
And the other thing is that natural drive to create human personal connection with, you know, anybody.
Yeah.
And you know, sometimes it may feel unnatural to treat somebody else as at a different level, as a patient, as perhaps an incarcerated person, as, you know, in that, I mean, I'm not sure, we're not machines, so it may be difficult to, especially
the,
if you're not
the human element.
The human element of creating that connection,
yeah.
And if you're not a professional that has gone through all of these trainings and maybe understands the gravity of the consequences, you know,
yeah.
Maybe a little
difficult. I wanted to talk a little bit about the music in this film, which I thought was well placed, and I liked all of the songs that were in it too. We start out with Simon and Garfunkel Bookends, and it was interesting because we were having, at the time that that song was playing, we were having lots of foreshadowing of what was going to happen at the end of the film. And so it was like bookends going on.
Mm-hmm.
And there was another time that there was a Wilco song playing about loneliness. And I think it was the only song that was not from the time period. But it was very well placed. It was right after that shrub thing. And we see Susanna dealing with her own loneliness. And I thought that was really interesting. When Susanna had a flashback to a high school dance, so she's dealing with the fluidity of time, and the song that comes on is Time, which I think was by the Chamber Brothers, but I'm not sure about that. And finally, we have Downtown, originally by Petula Clark, which is this iconic song from the 60s. And we hear it toward the beginning, and then we've got Susanna playing it on guitar, and Susanna and Lisa singing it to comfort Polly. And it seems to really bring the two of them together.
Mm-hmm.
And then we hear it finally at the very end over the closing credits. And I thought in all instances it was powerful, and by interspersing it throughout the film, I mean, the message of that song, which I haven't thought a lot about prior to this, is seems to be that there's so much going on, but there's something to strive for and to reach for. And so I saw it as a message of healing and hope.
And it was a great connector at times from, like, her flashbacks to the present.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
It worked really, really well that way, especially with the extreme close-ups they did in this film.
Yeah.
One of the ideas that I just got as you were speaking and as I was recollecting the film was thinking about bookends, and then I was thinking about the taxi driver and what he represented. And to me, it was almost like he was, I forgot the Greek name for him, but the person who ferries the dead to the underworld.
Across the River Styx.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, I was like, well, that it's almost a metaphor to purgatory, because the hospital is a place outside of the world where things are in motion, but they are not in the real world. It's a disconnect
mm-hmm.
from the real world. And it's also a disconnect that flirting with reality that we experienced in the beginning of the film, where what is time, what is reality, and that idea of death that Susanna talked about with her boyfriend during that time. She was like, well, these are just thoughts and stuff like that. And I was like, it's almost as if, like, her flirting with that idea in her mind, and that she talks a little bit later in the film where it's like, when you dream about death and when you are actually near death, it's a very different experience. So I wonder if there was any link between those ideas and Because death is being taken out of the real world. It's being taken away from all these stressors, away from, you know, theoretically, away from these troubles, these, you know, inconsistencies, these difficult times. And her stay in the hospital was kind of being plucked out of reality.
Okay, being plucked out of reality. And to me, that comes back to the title, Girl Interrupted.
Yep.
I had another comment to honor what you had mentioned. When Daisy, right after when Susanna comes back to the hospital and she's talking to Valerie, the questions that she wanted to ask Daisy, still around death. What is that force? It's repetition. One of the repetition scenes in the film, this discussion about death. What's it like? How does it feel? The moment. And then to have that reference of her being taken out of reality into the hospital.
Yeah.
I didn't think about the whole taxi driver, the cab driver's reference and his position in it, but in a sense, I guess it's almost as if, and he told her don't stay too long. So that was like, that's pretty interesting. Because even he says, you look fine to me, but don't stay too long. It's almost as if you want to experience this other side, take a trip to the mental health a unit, be there for a while, and then come back.
Like that shift in perspective.
Yeah. And it being like purgatory, it's so funny you say that, because like now that like you were going through it, like, I mean, she just had a suicide attempt beforehand as well.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's what I was saying. You know?
It's so funny. Like, I mean, you know, you hear all these conspiracy theories of like movies and whatnot, like, oh, what if they really died? And it's like, well, what if she really died? What if this was all just, like, purgatory?
That's a different take, yeah. But it's, like, as a metaphor, as symbolism, there's so much symbolism in this film.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah, and, gosh, I just want to say, I just think this is so insightful. And I had not considered this at all. So, and the taxi driver, when he says, don't be gone too long. We see him at the beginning, in the opening. And then when we see him again, he himself physically has changed. His hair is longer, he's got a beard, and she looks the same. But it's kind of an indicator of how much time has been spent.
Yeah.
And even, I had mentioned the Wilco song earlier. While that Wilco song is playing, then we are seeing scenes on the TV of Martin Luther King just having been shot. Yeah. And it's showing us that, like, life is going on outside.
Yeah. And, like, the draft.
And that involves death also.
Mm-hmm. And the draft as well.
Oh, yeah. And so as soon as his number is drawn,
he's dead.
Toby is dead.
Yeah.
And actually, Nurse Valerie said a similar line to Susanna, is don't stay here, like, too long. Like,
yeah, don't anchor yourself.
And I think also that connects to that, like, don't let this consume you. Don't stay, like, this is not where you belong. We all belong in, you know, a quote-unquote real world. This is only a transition. This is a learning, you know, maybe learning, but maybe like figuring yourself out, that whole identity developing space, but this is not where you belong. And shattering that conception of like, oh, maybe I am crazy,
this is the end all be all,
but it's not. Shattering there is that. A life,
which is what it seems to be for Lisa.
Mm-hmm.
In contrast.
Good stuff.
Absolutely. All right. Any more topics we need to hit?
I just want to go back earlier, I had said I thought the men were portrayed as negative. I think that's the wrong word. I think, and you had said doofus for Melvin. I think kind of weak.
Absolutely.
In contrast, it provides a contrast to the strength and power of the women in this film.
Not like a secondary character. However, I do think that the taxi driver was a neutral positive.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because.
Yeah.
Sure. I agree.
He offered some encouragement and, you know, that sense of not everyone's against you.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
You've got this. You can get out. You go, girl.
I love it.
All right. You want to talk about next week?
What's going on next week?
Well, next week we will be discussing our first documentary.
That's right.
The Devil and Daniel Johnston. And that will be led by...
Email about it. We're going to email about it.
It will be led by either Adam or Olivia.
Yeah,
or both.
If you're comfortable taking it on, take it. If not, let me know.
I will.
All right.
And before we wrap up, I do want to give a quick shout out because you're wearing a Cubs shirt today. It's a pretty huge event. The Cubs are making it to the World Series. I think it's the first time in 108 years.
Definitely.
Now, I'm not from here. I need to make sure that I'm very culturally sensitive to my people back home in Ohio, because the Cleveland Indians are also making it to the World Series, first time since I think the 60s.
Mm.
So we both have, you know, huge changes going on with our baseball teams here, and so I wanted to give a little shout out there. One of the teams will walk away with a World Series after decades and decades, and the other will walk away with 109 years without winning one.
Well, I'm happy that the Cubs have made it to the World Series. It's actually the first time since 1945. However, they haven't won the World Series since whatever year, 100 and...
I think it's 108 years. And the Indians were in it in the 90s, back when, you know, the Indians were cool, and we had Albert Bell and Kenny Lofton, and Charlie Sheen made a movie about
That's right.
But we haven't won since the 60s.
Yeah.
So, two long-standing teams. I wanted to give a little shout-out to Cleveland back home.
And the Cubs. Go
Absolutely.
Cubs!
Yes.
Go Cubs. Woo!
All right, as we wrap up, I really want to thank you all for listening to us and for your support. And yeah, this has been a great discussion this week. We're out, people. Bye.
All right.
See you next week.
Good drive.